It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready? Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and various ideas and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world with humour, wit and just possibly some technical talent. And speaking of talent, our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do the business. Ethan, welcome back to the show. How have you been?
Really good. It's a beautiful week here in New Hampshire. We've had great weather, and I've spent the week building and provisioning a lot of new equipment. The network I was hired needed a lot of care and feeding, and we've been going through defining what really needs to be replaced the most and getting new hardware in and replacing it. So I've been installing some 29 or 3900 series switches, and I got a pair of brand new LTM F5 Networks load balancers in that I'm nailing up this week.
And big ones? Little ones?
Middle of the road. They're the 3600s. They can handle more than we expect to need to throw at them, but we're expecting to grow into them. I've been talking with the data center systems administration manager, and we've got a lot of ideas of applications that are well-suited for load balancing in this environment and are going to bring it it's one of these deals where there's a lot of apps today that are doing the old school Microsoft load balancing, which is cheap and it's in the box, but it doesn't really work all that well. Yep. And bringing them into some real load balancing with some features and some redundancy and some performance. And so we're kind of excited about that. It's a good start to bring F5 into this environment. So it's been a really good.
You never go wrong with F5, really, do you?
Not in my experience. I'm an unashamed fanboy. I love the boxes. So there you go.
I must say I'm the same. And welcome back, Dan. How has your week been?
Thank you, Greg. I've had a fantastically busy week. All just about building scale, basically. certainly been keeping me very, very busy.
Okay. Well, I've returned from the HP Network Day this week, where I've been getting briefings on Hewlett-Packard's going-to-market strategy now that they've borged the 3Com people inside their organization. And it's been an interesting session. I met up with mostly a group of marketing people inside the organization. But I must say that for marketing people, they were strangely attached to the earth and seemed to have a fairly straightforward view of what they wanted to be achieving. So let me just give you a couple of bullet points about what I found out from the network day is that they're mainly going to be focusing on the enterprise. They don't appear to be attacking service providers or any sort of weird vertical markets like finance or whatever. Probably going to focus on the low to large end of the market. That is what I'm saying is not the very large. Everything from good-sized companies downwards in the lower end of the market. The 3Com product is entertaining. I haven't had a lot of detail on the 3Com product, and I'm hoping to get more exposure to it in the future.
Greg, I got a quick question on that. Now, by 3Com, that also includes the acquisition. When they did that 3Com acquisition, it's also the H3C, which is big in China. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. If you actually have a look at the product set, one of the interesting things is that the product set is very, very large. So they've kept all of the H3C, all of the ProCurve, and all the 3Com products, and they're not end-of-lifing anything yet. So the product line is very large. They've broken that into three pieces. There's V, which I think of as the value series, which is the cheap, you know, Linksys kind of stuff. They've come up with the E, which is mostly the ProCurve stuff at the entry-level point for most people. And then they've got the A series, which is the big iron, chassis-based, very large routers. That's the H3C stuff. Very different separations between the products, but there's a lot of overlap between them too. The 3Com product.
Do you think there'll be a sort of a clear out at some point? Or?
I think they're doing their best to keep the customers on side, and I think over time they'll narrow the product range down once they see who the winners are. I think it would be difficult to pick the winners at this point in time from the product family, so they'll run forward and see which ones work out the best. I'm not convinced about that. Having too much choice is the right idea. I've put a blog post on. Yes, Cisco does work for. One of the other interesting things is that they're quite keen to point out that they're going to be much cheaper than Cisco. I don't think they would have said cheaper, but I'm using that word, which is going to be attacking Cisco in their core weakness, which is that Cisco products are, well, very expensive comparative to the value that you're getting these days. In the past, we were quite happily paying it, but today we're seeing more and more questioning of Cisco's pricing policy. That leads me to believe...
Are they able to deliver?
Well, that's the two choices. I think one of the things is if they sell the product as, you know, say 30% cheaper than, say, an equivalent Cisco product, they're going to get quite good sales. You know, people are going to look at them and say, hey, this is HP, they're selling good product, we'll buy it, we'll get in there, because HP is already selling us our servers, they sell us our storage, they sell us all sorts of stuff. HP's a big company, they've got a good story, let's give it a go. That's going to undermine Cisco in a lot of accounts, I think, and Cisco's got to be in there selling servers to those people. I would rather be in HP shoes. That's going to be an easier story to win on. They have to – so if they execute on that, and one of the things that I think is that you only ever – it's not the first sale which matters. It's the second sale. The question is, if we buy the HP switches and deploy them in our networks, what happens – in the years to come? Do we actually go back and buy HP again because they've been successful? Or do we go, that's the first and last time I ever buy that product, I'm going back to Cisco?
Well, that's the concern some of the guys on Twitter seem to have posted that use HP products. They don't love working with them. They just say they don't work as well as maybe you'd think or hope, and they have various challenges. I haven't gotten into any specifics with the folks, but it seems like there's some question mark that the products deliver what they say they do, and or maybe there's some bug issues in the OS. I'm not sure, but there's some lack of confidence that people have expressed.
Do you think some of it could be down to familiarity? I remember once I was dealing with some Dell switches that, you know, while they might not be the best switches in the world, they kind of actually did what was required. But I hated working on them just because I wasn't familiar with their operating system. I was going to run commands that weren't actually there anymore, sort of thing. I wonder how much of the dissatisfaction is just lack of, you know, product knowledge and lack of training on the product.
Well, I know HP is trying to bridge that gap. They have this accelerated learning program that if you're a CCNP or CCAE already, they'll put you through. I'm not sure if it's free. I think it is free, actually. But there's a 4 or 5 hour online training course you can take, and then you can register to take their test, and they'll certify you as an HP, what do they call it, an ASC and a master ASC, I believe, for their campus line of certification, if you will. And that, obviously, they're recognizing that some people are challenged just because, hey, I know and love my Cisco stuff, and I don't want to work in anything else because it's what I know. So they're saying, all right, fine, we'll throw some training at you. It's not going to cost much, and we'll give you another fancy certification to put on your resume for what would seem to be minimal effort. You know, 4 or 5 hours, take some notes, do some thinking about it, and maybe you get lucky and go pass the test. So
I think that's one way to get through it. The other thing I noticed is that there's a big difference between the ProCurve products, which is what HP was selling before, which was their own custom silicon, custom developed, and really only a few years old. And I think they hadn't quite finished off the feature set. I was speaking to a HP engineer 6 to 9 months ago, and he was telling me different stories about the product and saying, you know, it's not that the features didn't work, they just hadn't been finished. You know, there was spanning tree, and when you turned on spanning tree, these things happened, and when you connected them with Cisco switches, you had to configure them this way. It was just that they hadn't been gotten around the full cycle, hadn't had enough time to round out the product. It's possible.
Sounds like Nexus.
Exactly, it does, yes. The A-series switches, which the 3Com... part of the 3Com acquisition, which is a really serious data center, Ryan, they run a piece of software which they told us about, which is Comware, and all the A-series switches, excepting for a few, there's always notable exceptions to these, but generally they all run this software called Comware, which would be equivalent to iOS, except that they all run the same image across all the devices, so the routers, the switches, and everything. And all of those products run merchant silicon, so there's no custom fabbing inside of the manufacturing process. So it's just a case of writing software with merchant silicon, getting the modules together, and then shooting them out. So potentially it's a far more valid form of going to market. So it looks more like the Arista strategy, perhaps, than you might think. in terms of the value, I mean, all of the software development and all the product manufacturing is done in China, whereas I'm led to believe that most Cisco iOS development is done in India. And there are divergent cultural differences between the two companies in the way they, you know, those countries about the way they do development. And generally, I would prefer Chinese software development to Indian software development because of their different approaches. But and that's an experience thing that I've had before with various projects. The other thing HP is doing is focusing very heavily on standards. They're not going to be developing new technology. They have a large commitment to the IEEE. They have several senior executives who are in the IEEE committees, and they believe that using IEEE standards for features and products is very important, which I think is going to lead to a lot of, emblogonation where people argue over the finer points of this feature or that feature, while HP says, well, that's not a standard, that's a proprietary extension. And Cisco's going to say, but, you know, we built these proprietary extensions because they add this functionality, which is what customers need. And we're going to have lots of going backwards and forwards, for example, that talk about that. So it'll be entertaining to see how that talks out. They also have some interesting stuff. They have the tipping point IPS and IDS, but as people know, we talked about this about 6 weeks ago. And generally, the use of IPS and IDS systems is a bit of a specialist art form. The interesting thing about the tipping point is it goes from the very, very small all the way up to the very, very large. They actually have this stackable IPS system, which was interesting.
Did they talk about taking the tipping point code and embedding it in something else? You see what I'm saying? Taking the software and throwing it on some other silicon hardware somewhere?
No. We had 60 minutes on the tipping point product, and it really wasn't enough time to get into the sort of details that I would have liked to have had. I know they have this stackable feature for the IPS. They have some interesting ways of doing SSL decode, which I thought was quite humorous. But they do have a leadership in security research because they have a program which actually pays for vulnerabilities. So if you're a security researcher and you locate an appropriate vulnerability in Microsoft or, you know, some, you know, common technology, they will pay you for that vulnerability at a reasonable price for what's going in the black market. So it actually funds security researchers to some extent. Mm. And therefore, their product is a long way ahead of what they also talk about. They also talked about their unified communication strategy, but I fell asleep at that point. I'm not a big fan of unified communications. I saw some interesting data center technologies. There's a thing called VEPR, which I'm going to do some more research into and take time on. We talked about the Virtual Connect line cards. I can see their point about Virtual Connect. I think I'm going to have a chat with Mike Witkowski, who was their Virtual Connect person. And I think I might record a runt packet in weeks to come about Virtual Connect and give him another chance to convince me. But as yet, I come to the view that Virtual Connect is less of a networking product and more of a fancy NIC. In the same way that Cisco's UCS has their converged network adapters, either their A-series, B-series, or C-series cards, which go into the UCS servers, they're very similar to that in concept, which I hadn't quite grasped up until now. I think the Virtual Connect stuff still remains a solution looking for a problem in that there are other ways to handle this, and I'm not convinced that Virtual Connect solves it. They've recently released some new stuff. The Flex 10 cards have been out for a long time, and they're very expensive, and I priced up some Flex Fabric modules this week, and they're $19,000 at list price each, which seems very generous for somebody. So you figure every virtual, you know, you're going to put two of those in every chassis, at least, or maybe four for a heavily used chassis. So that's a lot of money for a NIC card. Even if you can spread it amongst 8 or 16 blades, still fairly expensive. So I'm not 100% sure that I'm still in favor of that.
One other question I had about Virtual Connect, did it sound like they have a roadmap and a long-term plan for that product as opposed to say, hey, you know what, we're going to take some of our H3C stuff or something from the existing network family and turn it into a blade they can stuff into a blade center?
Well, that's what the Virtual Connect is. It is actually the networking component that goes in the back of the blade center.
Well, right. But my point being is it's unique. It doesn't really – it's its own thing as best as I can tell. I don't think it – whereas you can take a Cisco blade and stick it into a blade a center and it looks and feels and acts like a Cisco iOS box, Virtual Connect is kind of a different animal.
That's right. So you can get a pass-through card, which is what Cisco recommends you buy for HP blade servers, which basically presents NICs in each of the 8 blade servers and then presents on the back a cable for each server. So that is, if you have 8 full-height blades in a C-class chassis and you put a pass-through in, then all the network adapters on each blade then get presented on the back port. So it's like a patch cable coming off each blade out to the back. There's no backplane, there's no coherence. And then you patch that off. So each blade needs 6 or 8 cables and all that sort of stuff. And you end up with the same problems we've got today.
Sure, yeah.
So that's one way. The virtual connect idea goes right the other way of this and says, we have 8 blades, plug a virtual connect module into the back, be it a Flex 10 or a Flex Fabric, which is the new one. And then we can just virtualize that card in any number of flavors. So 2 Flex Fabrics in a HA pair can then be chopped up into 32 NICs or 64 NICs and then allocated logically, completely dynamically, and subject to certain rules and, you know, all that sort of stuff, up to whatever's on those blades. So whether that's Windows or Linux or VMware, you go down, you configure the Flex, and you say, I want a NIC over here and a storage adapter in there, and I want this. So a Flex 10 presents various forms of, takes the 10 gig Ethernet, chops it up into virtual NICs, and then presents it off to each blade chassis, blade center in the actual chassis itself. That's what Virtual Connect does at its root.
It's certainly a very nice concept, isn't it? I mean, the ability to sort of separate off each, you know, give each server as many NICs as it needs. You know, you can imagine sort of scenarios where all of a sudden you decide you want to do, you know, a particular service, if you like, on a VMware instance. And, okay, you need 2 NICs for it. Click, click, there you go. Okay, that was easy.
Well, that's what Cisco's UCS does, except they do it a little bit differently.
Absolutely. And they give you the fiber channel over token ring as well, of course.
Well, what I was really getting after is where Cisco will give you a Nexus 1000V. That's a, you know, a virtual switch that you can do all of these exact things that you're talking about with. A virtual connect. And again, on the Nexus 1000, it runs an operating system that you're familiar with, and you can manage it in a similar way to other Cisco hardware that you use. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Virtual Connect is really a unique product within the HP networking line. And if you go to some other HP switch, it doesn't look or feel or act like any of those other ones. It's its own thing.
I think that's always going to be the case, because it's doing a very different thing, though, isn't it? You know, it's you're asking it to do the configuration you're going to put onto it is doing different functions than, you know, what you would do with a conventional switch.
It's different. It's a NIC, right? It's a NIC card. It's not a switch. It's not a router. It's not a... Whereas the Nexus 1000V replaces the virtual switch inside of VMware. That's completely different. The Nexus 1000V only works in VMware. It replaces the software switch inside of vSphere or VMware. Has no other function at all. In the back of the blade center, the Virtual Connect is a hardware network adapter that can be virtualized at the hardware layer before it actually gets into the software side.
Whereas, so is the forwarding in Virtual Connect hardware based? So I mean, does it have ASICs? Is it forwarding frames in hardware?
Has fancy. It has all the TOEI and all that sort of stuff for high speed IP. The Flex Fabric does combined fiber channel as well as Ethernet, so it can present multiple virtual fiber channel cards up to the thing. And in the future, there'll be some fiber channel over Ethernet. It'll do iSCSI boot and all these other things that you're looking for. I haven't got all the notes in front of me, and I haven't memorized it as yet. So,
sure,
those sorts of in the UCS chassis, there's these A series and B series adapters, and they are the NIC cards that go into the mezzanine slot. Mezzanine slot is a fancy name for PCI slot inside of a UCS blade. I never really worked that out for a long time. They talk about mezzanine cards, and the mezzanine cards is that they've got an extension of the PCI bus, which plugs into a daughter board where they plug in a fancy NIC. So in both the UCS servers and the HP servers, they have what they call MES cards, where they plug in these fancy NICs. In UCS, and to some extent, the Flex Connect or the Flex Virtual Connect cards and the UCS adapters both are hardware virtualization. So they actually logically instantiate from one NIC many virtual NICs. The Nexus 1000V is a piece of software that goes on VMware only. So if you've got a UCS blade or a HP blade and then you install Windows or Linux, Nexus 1000V has no part to play. Because it's not VMware. The only time Nexus 1000V is useful is if you've got a VMware server over here and you've got another one on the other side of the data center and you want to migrate that VMware machine from there over to there and you want the switching configuration, the ports and the port profiles and the VN tag and all that Nexus 5000 and information, you want it to go with it to say over there, I now need that VLAN on that side of the data center, then Nexus 1000V goes over there with it. And it takes care of all the configuration.
I'm getting beat up here, but I only had one point, which was I'd like to see HP networking product lines become more unified so that if I'm managing a virtual connect module, it looks and feels like other HP networking gear. I would argue that it's not that unique of what it does. It does .1Q. It does LACP.
It's not a networking thing at all. That's the mistake I've been making is that it's a switch or it's a router or it's a whatever. It's not. It's a NIC.
It's definitely not a router. I would argue that it is a switch in some ways, having worked on them before. It does have some unique connections to the Blade Center for sure, and that you can set up profiles for servers and different things like that that you can then use to provision a new blade as it goes in and present networking to it.
The reason I don't like it is because they say it saves time by letting the server admin create not only the server configuration but also the network configuration and the storage configuration. And the person who creates that configuration is often the least competent individual. The person who spends all day turning up servers and getting them ready for installation is not normally the smartest man in the team. It's normally somebody who's, you know, down in the engine room doing the operational day-to-days. And when they light up a connection onto a VLAN and just, you know, and turn on the SAN and attach to this and all this sort of stuff, you're not necessarily giving it to the best person to be evaluating the ramifications of those decisions, and that loss of control is what concerns me.
Think of it another way. Think of it as delegation rather than loss of control. I don't want to be doing that. Do you want to be doing that? Oh, God, some guy wants to plug a server in. I have to do some work. You don't want to be running a network that way.
You'll be doing it anyway, though, because these guys a lot of times are challenged by the things that they're asking their servers to do. So you'll end up on the phone with them anyway, going through virtual connect configs, trying to sort out how come this doesn't see this and how come this MAC address is showing up on this VLAN. That doesn't make any sense and so on. So a lot of times you end up having to do it anyway.
True. It's much easier if you do it yourself the first time out. Anyway. So for the rest of the show, we want to focus on customers, our customers, which is you, the listener. Many of you have taken the time to send in user feedback and questions to us, for which we are eternally grateful, and many of you have just written in to say thanks. But mostly, I want to look at questions where people have mailed in specific questions and asked us to talk about them, because we listen to your emails and to things, and we're possibly going to do some more in this area in the future. So let's start off with Dan, who emailed in the question, which says, you guys have talked about Spanning Tree and Trill, but I haven't heard much on VLAN management, namely the new VTP competitor, MVRP. To be honest, Cisco and Juniper documentation gloss over MVRP, while there's tons of info on VTP from Cisco. Brocade doesn't seem to have anything, and from what he reads about, if one chooses to move to MVRP, it sounds kind of scary. He says the main reason it even came to my attention was the need for it to provide VLAN pruning using a non-proprietary protocol. It says, hopefully I'm not doomed to appear in this don't be this poor bugger slide of someone's networker's presentation. Have you guys heard of MVRP or seen anything about it?
Are you talking to us?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, dear.
So that obvious answer is I haven't spent any time with it. There you go. How about that? For the definitive world-class pool of resources.
Yeah. There is a thing. This talks about there's a multiple VLAN registration protocol, apparently it stands for. It's a replacement protocol for GVRP, which I still haven't heard about. I did some reading on it, and it does look like an open source version of VTP, where it actually uses protocol to propagate VLAN numbers from switch to switch so that they would all know about each other. I hadn't particularly heard of any particular one of the vendors promoting it, because I think VTP is not all that popular. I'm one of the few people who believe in VTP as a viable administration technology, and I think last time we went around the table, I think I was the only one. When we did big, hot, and heavy switches.
No, I'm a fan
Jeremy
of this as
likes
well.
it. Jeremy Philbin likes it too.
Yeah, I've used it in a lot of places. It's got its cons, but it's got its pros as well. You know, it's there's a balance. I've also seen things being horribly broken by it, though. I mean, a lot of the guys I work with would hiss at you, I think, if you actually suggested putting VTP on a network. So I know a lot of people are quite anti it. But the difficulty is, you know, unless you can build a VLAN propagation system which is going to give you the sort of reliability that we come to expect from things like routing protocols and what have you, I think people are always going to have the concern and the sort of slight fear that they have from being bitten by VTP over the years. And if this is just a sort of an open source VTP type protocol, I don't see how it's going to fix those issues. Now, I'm saying that with, you know, not having particularly read about it and in absolute ignorance, but you know, really the question is it addressing the issues other than, you know, the fact that VTP is Cisco proprietary? Is it addressing the issues that VTP actually has? And if yes, then it's interesting.
Well, it's in the Cisco documentation, IEEE 802.1ak, MVRP, and it looks as if it's been implemented in code somewhere. And mainly
somewhere.
I just wasn't aware of it, and I guess I haven't had it raised to my attention. I haven't, even in my work with Nortel or, you know, any of the other vendors, I haven't seen any implementations of MVRP. But anyway, I guess, Dan, thanks for writing in. Interesting question, and I'm not 100% sure we can answer it because we haven't seen it raised in any of the discussions or any of the research that we're doing. Kyle Duran writes in by email, "Hey, it would be cool to hear you guys talk about some of the high bandwidth service provider topics, like maybe some of the Cisco optical networking stuff or DWDM. Kyle, I'd love to, but really it's just not anything that I know much about. Any of you guys doing anything in that field?"
Just been on a course for it this week, actually, and we certainly use it quite extensively. And I have to say, I was actually unable to attend the first half day of the course, and which is my problem. I came in sort of halfway through. Because it comes from a telco background as opposed to from a, you know, computer's background, if you like, that IP networking does, it has its own complete terminology, its own sort of system background. Talking to the guys who use it fairly extensively in the place I work, they said it's actually very straightforward. It's a Lego set, you know, and you just take the bits of Lego and you kind of click them together, and you know, it does its thing. So I don't think there's any huge rocket science to it. But the barrier to entry to it, for me, was the basic terminology. Once you'd got beyond that, it gets, you know, quite straightforward, and there's some quite clever stuff. I mean, we were sort of, you know, moving circuits around DWDM networks. I think they've made a lot of changes to the administration software on the Cisco one. The guy was showing us the new tweaks, and a lot of our guys were getting really excited about it because, you know, it actually fixed a lot of the usability problems. So it actually looks kind of simple to use. You know, you need to run a 10 gig circuit from here to here. Click, 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 go. Okay, you know. Ta-da!
I guess the reason I'm not likely to talk about it is I don't know anything about it, so it's hard for me to discuss it intelligently. I have some.
You need to have a serious requirement for it, and you know, you need to be sort of generating vast amounts of bandwidth from A to B, because these things are big, big money.
And A to B would be typically like a long haul sort of thing where you're going many, many kilometers between nodes. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean. And again, you've got to bear in mind these things are not developed even for organizations like the guys I work for, who, you know, who have data centers around the world, but that they are really designed for telcos. You know, this is for phone companies basically that are going to run their sort of SDH circuits and T1s, D1s, and metro services and all kinds of different things over, you know, the bits of string that are physically in the ground.
Yeah, it's all associated with mostly these days associated with dark fiber. You put in dark fiber and then you light up a DWDM ring and then you can mux multiple 10 gig, 1 gig channels over there and you pay per lambda or bandwidth.
Yeah. Now, what I did use a few years ago, actually, which was much more sort of applicable to what most people, and it's useful to be aware that this actually exists. Cisco do a low-end a passive optical system. So it's literally a shelf with a bit of glass inside it. If you can get a bit of dark fiber from A to B, You plug it into, you know, one end. You plug it into your common receive on one end, and you plug your common transmit onto the other. And I think I can't remember, was it an 8 or a 16 wavelength system. So there's no administration, there's no GUI, there's no nothing. There's just you plug your bits of fiber into the right sockets, and there's, so you just put your connectivity. You know, you put your one link into the front, and you transmit into the other end, and there's a bit of glass inside it, and it literally breaks you out into 8 or 16. I actually can't remember whether it was 8 or 16 different channels. There's no administration, there's no GUI, there's nothing you've got to think too hard about. But it just turns your one bit of fiber into 16 bits of fiber. So if you do have connectivity between two locations, if you do have your own bit of dark fiber, or you're paying money for a bit of dark fiber, you can relatively inexpensively turn it up to, you know, from 1 gig to 16 gig, which is kind of nice.
There's some coarse wave division modules for 3750s, which you can use for something very simple too, where you can actually.
That's right.
Up.
Yeah, this particular one was dense rather than coarse, but I know you could get the coarse. I think the coarse one was actually even cheaper again, because we did look at that at the time, and Cisco were trying to push us towards the dense one, and we kind of.
That's because it sells for more money. The coarse stuff's reasonably cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's move on. So the next topic is Citrix NetScaler. Hans, I hope I said your name right. It's H-A-N-N-N-E-S. Hans says, I constantly get comments from the Citrix guys here at work about how great the NetScaler is supposed to be. Personally, I don't know a whole lot about load balancers, and that's why I'm sending this to you guys. I know you've talked about this a couple of times before, but maybe a whole show dedicated to the subject would be nice. Well, a whole show dedicated to... dedicated to NetScalers would be about as exciting as about a slap with a salmon.
Which is exciting, actually.
I actually worked with the NetScalers before Citrix bought them. Not a bad product insofar as they go. They were originally developed as a fancy NIC card that did load balancing. They have some nice features, but in my way of thinking, they're now an application accelerator for Citrix. They're now so tightly bound with the Citrix product that you wouldn't actually buy them as a load balancer. They have all these great features that do things for Citrix in terms of profiles, routing and security, SSL, VPNs, lots of stuff, but they're not good load balancers because that's not the core product that Citrix has been focusing on with them. I do know that some people have purchased them as load balancers and have been reasonably happy with them, but as somebody who comes from an F5 Cisco ACE background, I'm more likely to move to somebody who's focusing on a load balancer as a load balancer and not as a Citrix application accelerator. Ethan, you got any views?
Not on NetScaler particularly. I mean, the world I live in, F5 and Cisco ACE seems to be what folks are using, and F5 predominantly and growing. F5 is doing all the right things right now to continue to gain market share, which is something that a lot of folks are having trouble doing, is gaining market share in whatever their particular space is. F5 is, and for all the right reasons. It's not just marketing hot air. They've got a great product. So at some point, I may see what I can find out about NetScaler, but haven't had any compelling feature, pricing, or other thing that they were doing that's like, oh gosh, I got to get serious and evaluate this box.
Yeah, I've got to say, I'm a big fan of the F5 product. I used it a lot in my last place, and I didn't like it particularly when I first went to it because it didn't feel like a network device. But it's one of those things, once you start using it, you fall in love with it very quickly, and you wouldn't go anywhere else. The only thing I do know about the Citrix ones is they scale really well.
I found them very fast. I found they do actually scale quite nicely. The products that I were using a bit early in the cycle, so I can only assume that the products developed on. My main concern is that Citrix is not a networking company. They're a software company, and the product would probably reflect that lack of focus for enterprises. Mm-hmm. They'd be, you know, great for load balancing Citrix, no problem with that. But using them for other things might be... Well, there's two types of load balancing in this world. There's simple TCP, HTTP load balancing, that sort of stuff. I think they'd work very well at that. If you want to do something rather more sophisticated, such as application load balancing, then I'd be leaning towards the F5. If you're doing dumb TCP load balancing at scale, I'd lean towards the ACE module. But even then, I'm not a big fan of the ACE module these days because of software bugs and problems. I've had them barf on me several times, and I've not been happy to recommend them in the last 2 years.
they seemed to really miss the ball on the ACE, actually, didn't they? I mean, the CSS was had its faults, but once you kind of got them running, they ran really well. I've yet to find many people who turn around and say, "Wow, ACE, it's just ACE."
No, I think anybody who's had one has been less than pleased in the long run, and that's been my experience. Mm. It's a product that I've bought once, and I won't be buying a second time. A couple of other people have written into us and said thanks, for which I'm personally grateful because we do put a fair bit of work into the show. Sam Clements writes, "Just caught my first Packet Pushers podcast, the illustriously and proudly named Bum Bugling on Cisco Clean Air with Jennifer Lucille," and he says he'll now be a regular subscriber. Keep up the good show. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate your feedback. Chris Welsh writes and said, "Just to say I'm so glad I found your podcasts." He lives in Western New South Wales, and he heard my analogy on the show about using a 2.5-foot pig knife to peel an apple as an appropriate way to using an IDS to filter web traffic. So there you go, you two. Up yours, right?
I wasn't there for that episode, but I remember listening to it in the car the next day thinking, why does Greg know so much about knives? And I just had this kind of this Paul Hogan kind of moment. So never play knifey spoony against this guy.
Oh, there you go. When I was at school, we used to do our school camp was to go out into the bush of Central Australia, and we couldn't take any meat with us, so you had to kill it yourself. So I learned lots after that about it there. Hank Preston wrote in and said, "Working as a sales engineer, I've been catching up on some of the podcasts and listened to the one by you and Kevin about working for a reseller. That, of course, is the Runt Packet with Kevin Bovis, who is a technical services manager for a reseller. He said he's had experience of working as an end user of equipment and as a reseller, but never directly for a vendor. And I was wondering what your thoughts might be on this area of networking and whether any of us have had an SE position with any of the networking vendors." Anybody? Not me.
Nope.
Now, the closest I can come is just working as a working for a consultancy that was a reseller where we were a Cisco partner and having to sell stuff that way. But yeah, never for a Cisco or an F5. Yep. But if I could pick someone, I think I'd work for F5 because I wanted to make that plug again. I want to see if we can get people saying F5 must pay you guys. Why do you talk like that? That's
great. It's a shame when things.
Better be if they would pay us, but
it would be better. I personally have not much desire to work for a vendor. In the past, I've found that working for a vendor would be not to my personal way of lifestyle, and they often don't pay nearly as well as you think. To date, I haven't had any joy with negotiating a suitable job role with any vendor, and I don't imagine myself doing it. However, I do know people who have worked as SEs and have learned an awful lot in a very short period of time. I think we've talked about this in our career development episode some time back, where we said if you go and work for a reseller for about 2 years, you'll learn everything you need to know very, very quickly, and then you go on and get a real job. I would class loosely an SE position for a vendor in something like that. Bob Ramiro writes in and says, "Greg, I'm a network engineer working as a consultant for a regional carrier. I run GNS3 labs constantly and have built networks for the last 14 years. The question is, I have access to an entire library of Cisco press books on a server down the hall. I've got 3 Cisco SEs on speed dial, and you know I'm in a high-touch account where I can get access to technical information and resources pretty easily. What he misses out on is non-lab and deployment stuff like Twitter. The podcast has been great friends. So his question is, can you use Twitter to do your job?" Wow. Twitter's a big part of my working. It lets me reach out and communicate with people like Ethan and Dan. So the way that we got together to set up this podcast was we knew each other from chatting backwards and forwards over Twitter. I personally have had 2 instances where I was working and I needed to get a question answered. I was able to post the question on Twitter and get a response within an hour from people who really knew what they were talking about, and then incorporate that into solving a problem. I would recommend you get on Twitter. Don't spend a whole lot of time on it. Don't get too caught up with it because it can suck up your life. Anybody else?
That's
Dan?
The big problem of it, yeah. No, I've done very similar things and you know, I need to find out a particular thing. And what's great is it doesn't have to be specifically a networking thing. You can kind of ask anything and somebody will know. But I've actually stopped having Twitter up at work now. We're allowed to, no one minds, but I just find it sucks too much time away. It's kind of one of those things that I'll turn on at lunchtime, I'll turn on at the beginning of the day, maybe the end of the day, have a quick check. But it can suck up huge amounts of time otherwise.
Yeah, I tend to tweet more than I actually read posts. There's too many people to follow and keep up with everything that everybody's saying. A lot of people have nothing to say, but they're saying it anyway. I'm just not interested in what they have to say because it's just mindless. A lot of it's also interesting as well. But I guess I've gone the route where Twitter for me is more the social community where if I want someone else who understands what the heck I'm about to say to feel my pain, I'll put a tweet out there. and then I'll get back, you know, people who either retweet it or reply to it or comment on it, something like that. So there's a sense of someone else understands, you know, you have this happy sense that even if no one else around me at my job has, you know, understands what I'm going through, that the Twitterverse does. So that's fun. I had some fun this week where I tweeted something along the lines of, hey, if you're going to come complain about a problem, you got to have details. Saying the network is slow is not enough, which got retweeted like 10 times. I don't know. It was a lot. Because, again, that sense of community. All of us that work in networking have been there and feel that. And, yeah, it's just nice to see that someone else is going through what you're going through. As a technical resource, it's not bad. I've met up with some of the checkpoint challenges I've been running into, particularly with these older platforms. I've run into a guy who he and I, Twitter was really the jumping off point. We found each other through Twitter and who one another follows. And then he picked up on that I was a Checkpoint user, and he's, you know, really a hardcore Checkpoint guy. I've been doing a lot of Checkpoint for a lot of years, and I've had some different challenges. We've met up on Skype later, and which is, you know, much better for IM and whatever. And he's been helpful with suggestions and things as I'm trying to work out some Checkpoint stuff. So it's been great in that regard. There's a lot of nice people out there. There's a lot of people that are just interested in being helpful. So it's good in that sense.
I've got some advice for people. If they want me to follow you, then don't talk about your football team. Don't talk about your watching television. Don't tell me that you've just been to a restaurant. Don't use Foursquare.
Oh, gosh.
Don't put your Nike stuff in there because I will unfollow you if you do any of that instantly.
I've had to as well because it's you can't follow everybody, so there's an easy way to thin the herd. Okay, I'm not following you because half the stuff you tweet about is I just took a dump at work. Foursquare, I don't want to know that you're the mayor of your bathroom at work. I don't want to know.
I also don't care that you follow a baseball team of some name that I've never seen in my life. I also don't care that you're driving your car. I don't care. You know, think about the people who are going to be listening to what you say. And if you're going to postulate some drivel, then people aren't going to listen to you. I work hard in my Twitter stream to just put out technical content. If you are going to have a Twitter where you want to pop out the fact that you're popping off for a poop, then by all means, sign up for a second Twitter account and use that one and get your family and friends to follow that one and then have a technical one over here. Oh, and my other big beef about Twitter is if you are going to sign up and retweet something for a free chance to win an iPad, which you'll never win, because they never give them away or something equally idiotic, don't say, you know, then sign up for another account. Have a third one, which is I'm not telling anybody, you know, type thing, and use that. They're free, right? You can put – and if you're going to Twitter your weight, I'm also going to unfollow you as well because that's just not very interesting. So think about the people. If you want people to listen to what you're saying, if you want to add value to the community, then make sure that what you're saying is useful. Nobody cares that you're the mayor of your bathroom. I agree entirely. Neil Meadows wrote in and said, just like to say how nice it is to listen into people talking tech. And in brackets, he says, one of the reasons is I realize that there are other people as sad as me. Hey, that's us.
You found us.
You found
welcome
us.
Welcome home.
So he said, he makes some other comments here, which are a little bit hard for us to address here, but he says basically that the show gives him the vital keywords that he needed to search with authority and get to the information he needed. So by listening to us talk about it, he got some basic concepts and basic ideas and some keywords of which he was able to then go and hit the Google with. And then he said that the other part of the show that I found personally interesting is that I can measure myself against your technical knowledge. Scary. Very scary. Considering
you might want to find a higher bar somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Considering that my motto is never let knowledge get in the way of a solution, you probably not such. Anyway, so he says, which means that I can quickly realize where I am deficient and where I have a little expertise, but most importantly is a realization that it's impossible to know it all. However, the difficulty still remains in matching knowledge and skills to what employers are actually looking for and how to stay relevant for the next couple of years. So he said, keep it up. I'm enjoying it immensely. And a little more in-depth on the configuration issues would also be nice, apart from that top stuff. And I look forward to hearing very much more. Neil, thank you for writing in. I really appreciate that. Andrew Crutchfield writes in and says he'd like to see more in careers. I think we've done careers to death, to be fair. We will probably revisit careers in a 2 or 3 months' time, but there's only so much talking about someone else's life that I care to go on about. It's much more interesting to talk about myself.
Really, Greg?
I just think I hadn't noticed that. Boy, this is a revelation.
No, that's not true. We'll talk about careers whenever we get the opportunity, as we have done, where the opportunity comes in. A big part about why we set up the podcast and why I set up my blog was to help people move forward in their careers and to mentor them. So we will continue to address careers as time goes by.
What I found interesting, like about that particular email and some of the other tweets and emails I've seen from folks and people that comment on the packetpushers.net blog site, is there are a lot of people earlier in their career who are really ramping up their networking knowledge, figuring out what this whole networking career thing is all about. And they're just at a very, they're where maybe we were, 5, 8, 10 or more years ago, just depending on where we're at, what our jobs were, where our minds were at. And it's like, there's almost an assumption on my part, like, gosh, I'm almost embarrassed to talk because all these people that are listening to us probably know as much or more than I do anyway. And, how much do I have to add really? And am I just here because I want to talk? And then I find out, well, actually, there are a lot of guys listening who, and maybe some girls too, who are just getting started in the whole networking career. And to them, this is all like, this is good information, a lot of stuff that they didn't know, and opens up their mind to new possibilities, new way of doing things, understanding issues that are out there in networking and why it's important. So that was, to me, something to keep in mind, what the full range is of the audience out there that listens to the show. And so, again, keep the emails coming. It helps us know how best to build the shows.
It certainly does, and it actually gives us a bit of a boost. I mean, the big reason that we did the show was to put something back, and knowing that people are out there listening helps us a lot. I'd like to take a break now, sponsor break for Esculta Training. Esculta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States, which offers an array of advanced Cisco courses addressing multiple technologies. Using authorized Cisco course material and strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and consistently have high customer satisfaction ratings. Esculta provides their training using various delivery methods to meet your needs. And in addition to an extensive public class schedule across the United States, Esculta excels in developing and delivering customized training. They are partners with Cisco for course development with known and industry-experienced instructors. They have the right solution for you. You can reach them at 1-800-297-4294 or find them on the web at www.esculta.com. And there is a blog at blog.esculta.com, and they are on Twitter as @esculta, where they occasionally punch out a special offer if you're following them. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, even when you're on Twitter, and you'll get a $250 discount to get you started. That's Esculta Training, and they want you to learn something. So we should look a little bit at the fact of the week. I think, Ethan, you've got a fact of the week for us this week.
I have a fact of the week that I discovered working on some an older Cisco 6500 catalyst switch with the Soup 2 engine, and that is you cannot put more than 16 HSRP standby groups. You can run HSRP in more than 16 interfaces, but you can't run more than 16 of the HSRP standby groups on that, or else it's going to complain at you. Depending on the version of iOS, that is running on that soup too. It may let you configure more, but as of the 17th group, it's going to start switching that traffic in software. And in later versions of iOS on that soup too, it won't even let you do it. And that was a bit of a revelation to me. I've been used to working on soup 720s where 256 groups is the max. And so running into 16 was a surprise. Not that it's a big deal. All you do is just reuse your group number on different interfaces. But depending on how some folks write their standards, that's a potential irritation for them. But, and some folks might be thinking, well, hey, if I run the same group number on multiple interfaces, then am I not going to have the same MAC address? Because HSRP uses that group number in part to formulate the MAC address of the virtual IP. And the answer is, yeah, that's true. You'll have the same MAC address on multiple interfaces, but that's not a problem because your Cisco switches are going to track those MAC addresses in across multiple VLANs as essentially a separate VLANs where you've got a per bridging table for each VLAN. So it's going to work just fine, which was the solution to my problem. Instead of having a unique HSRP group number for each VLAN like I wanted to do per the standards that I've been writing at work, which is, yes, a blog post that I'm going to get back to. For those of you who remember, I started a blog post on that a while ago. I just reused the standby group number, and problem solved. Life is good.
There's always a way out. That's a bit of a gotcha, though, isn't it? Only 16 when normally you're sort of expecting it to be the what it is for everything else.
Yeah, there's a lot of soup twos out there, but I'm guessing not too many folks are buying those new. I'm not sure, maybe. I mean, you can still buy them as far as I know. The soup 720s are pricey, but yeah.
Well, there's supposed to be a successor to the soup 2 coming, which is the soup 2E enhanced. And as far as I know, it's been delayed perhaps for 18 months now because of manufacturing challenges. And I'm led to understand that the reseller industry is going nuts over the fact that they've been promised these, but they haven't shipped. I think they've actually been in ordering and then haven't come out. So Cisco is continuing to have challenges with delivery. There's a question here from Andrew Crutchfeld, who says, I would really love you guys to continue the careers podcast. Bit of a message there, isn't it? I picked up a lot of good info on that one. Right now, he is pinned to a help desk job with his CCNA and really wanting to get into networking somehow. He has his own lab, but I really want to hear your guys' opinion on going for CCNP with no networking experience at all. Am I overshooting this? A lot of my curiosity about the CCNP has stemmed from just reading IP documentation at work. I really want to get into networking, and a lot of the root switch material really intrigues me. I'm going to go ahead and go at the CCNP with no experience at all, but what jobs should I be applying for? What do you think about the new CCNP track versus the old?
Andrew, I was thinking about the part of your question where you say, you know, is it crazy to get my CCNP, but I don't really have any experience in networking? What kind of job should I be applying for? And the thing, I mean, this question comes up a lot from different people where they say, well, you know, I'm a CCNP, I'm a CCA, I should have this kind of a job. And I think what a lot of people are looking for in an interview is they're going to look at your certification and go, okay, cool. You've proved you have a certain baseline kind of knowledge. But if I'm the guy that's interviewing you, I guess you could say I'm impressed that you've got the certification, yes, but I'm also going to quiz you about your actual practical hands-on experience. What kind of data center environments have you been in? What kind of things have you done? What, you know, in the real world? Because the tests tend to not be all that realistic realistic in the sense of they're not a realistic reflection of what it's like to do a networking gig every day.
Because an exam can't test real life.
No, it can't. Yeah. It can't test what happens when someone comes up to you and all they say, like I tweeted this week about the network, is slow. Okay, if that's all they're going to tell you, then you have to take your knowledge of the network and that person and what they said and what it is that's slow and take it into a troubleshooting exercise and go forward, which is something there's no Cisco exam can test you on. The Cisco exam can test you on your knowledge of a protocol. It can test you on your knowledge of maybe some basic troubleshooting, how to do some rudimentary configurations, some of the cookie cutter kind of stuff. But it can't take all of that and apply it to that real-world situation that makes you, you know, a network engineer that that can resolve problems quickly, that knows the keywords to hear from different people, that knows the kind of questions to ask to get that information you need to solve that problem. So if you're sitting there across from the interview table from someone, unfortunately, that certification is not the ticket to go. So, okay, all of that's to get to this point. What kind of job should I be applying for? Well, you know, shoot for the stars if you want, but expect that realistically you're going to have a better shot at more of a low to mid kind of a job where you are underneath some sort of an engineering staff. You know, you're maybe first or second level support at best. You're not going to be that senior level person yet, not from the get-go. Realistically, you're going to be starting to get that experience, you know, again, at that first, you know, initial responder, the triage kind of a person, maybe a second level person that's building kits and so on. You're probably not going to be doing design work or architecture work until you've been in that job for a little bit and you prove yourself. And some of the things you picked up in getting your CCNP kind of make sense, and you can apply them, and you have a good working relationship with your coworkers, and then you begin to step up.
I mean, just because you don't have any networking experience doesn't mean you're not going to pass. You can do your CCNP with no networking experience, and that's going to be a door opener into your next job, because your employer is going to look at that and go, hey, he passed that exam. He doesn't have any field experience, but that's his first step. Now, you're not going to get the same pay. You know, if you've got a CCNP and 10 years experience and you can talk knowledgeably about a range of topics, someone else is going to get a higher pay or more likely to get the job. But that doesn't stop you from taking that step. And secondly,
I did exactly the same thing. I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, I did exactly the same thing. You go aggressively after those certifications as a way to get into that next level and function at that higher level. So sure, yeah, if you're willing to study, put the time and get the coursework done, pass the tests, very valuable and very worthwhile, and definitely can open the door, like you were saying, Greg, that maybe otherwise wouldn't have been open for you if you hadn't gone after the cert.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you sell yourself for a price. If I've got someone on the table in front of me who's got a CCNA and 2 years experience, or a CCNP with no experience, but someone who can talk knowledgeably and has learned and knows the topics, and I can ask them technical questions and they can answer them, I'm going to lean towards a guy with the CCNP in certain cases. So don't be afraid of not having any networking experience at all, because you can get that, but you can't get your fundamental knowledge. And this comes back to, I've previously written a post on my blog which says experience matters, but certifications are more important. And I talk more about why the certifications are important, and that's because it teaches your fundamentals. I can take somebody who knows how OSPF works and why it works and put them in the field and have a greater confidence that they'll be able to translate that into something useful than somebody who's got 10 years experience but wouldn't know how OSPF works. Just because you know something that you've done before doesn't mean you know how to solve a problem that you haven't been challenged by before. And that's what I'm looking for in people.
It's actually quite amazing how many people you see in interviews who come in and they've got, you know, lots and lots of experience that way. And when you actually get them to run through something like, you know, how does OSPF work? How does spanning tree work? One of my favorites is, you know, you sort of draw up a little spanning tree, you know, three switches kind of thing, and say, okay, which port's going to go into blocking? And they can't tell you. They've relied so much on their experience. And the problem with a lot of the relying on experience stuff is you're down to relying on things that you've seen before. And if people are working in sort of repetitive environments, then they've only seen a certain number of things. And yeah, they've seen them lots of times. But as you say, Greg, it's that knowing why things happen that the certification program gives you. And, you know, I wrote a program, a post before saying, you know, it's not about the certificate. It's about how you got there. And what you learned while doing the certification that's actually useful. The certificate itself doesn't matter two hoots. And that will show in the interview. You know, if you understand the where's and why's of it, it will show.
Andrew Kay writes in and says, I enjoy the topics you guys cover because you're talking about mostly bleeding edge data center. Apologies for that. It's a bit of a hobby of mine. And new protocols, techs, as well as buzz around the industry. He works for a ISP and deals a lot with smaller customer ISRs as well as the big metro switches and some big distro routers. Everything here is layer 3. Actually, there's one thing I'd like to hear your thoughts on. How do you go around picking an iOS? I have a hell of a time digging up iOSs for our 7606 core routers. How do you find the best, most bug-free iOS for use for mission-critical routers? Dan, that sounds like your area.
Yeah, I was going to say 7600. You probably go for a Safe Harbor release. It's a difficult one. If you're in Nexus land, it's very difficult because there's no such thing as Safe Harbor, of course.
Well, there's no stable release. Well, that's not true. There's a 4.1 release, which is supposedly.
Well, Nexus came from Sam. They're all stable. Hey,
there's no... Well, that's right. Yeah.
That's the pitch.
If I hear that one more time. But no, it's a very difficult question. And the first thing you have to do is actually decide what features you actually need to be running, because that can have a big determining factor in it. You know, if you need particular bells and whistles, you might actually have to take yourself away from a Safe Harbor release and increase your risk, if you like, your risk profile to get the tweaks and knobs that you need. It's one of those things that it's to an extent it's relatively mathematical. So you know you need to look at things like how important is stability to you. Some places you go to, they say there is nothing more important than stability. I don't care if we don't have OSPF max metric or whatever. You know, it's stability is numero uno. Other places need the new tweaks and bells and are banging on Cisco's door saying, hey guys, put this in and put that in, I need it. So there's kind of a trade-off there, and to an extent you need to decide that way what it is that you want from it. Once you have that, it's relatively straightforward in that you can go into things like the feature navigator. You can say, I need this, 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 and this, and it'll kind of spit back a few different options for you. If you're quite demanding in terms of your iOS releases, then you know you're probably going to have to be on latest version to get all the features you need. If you're not, hopefully you'll find something in there which is Safe Harbor. The other aspect to it then obviously is your own testing. So you do actually need to take these things out and put them into the lab and test them in your environment to make sure that what you are doing with this device will actually work and work reliably. You know, give it a bit of time in that. It's difficult when you're into the bigger platforms like the 7600s in that, you know, obviously it's quite expensive to have one of them sitting there running new versions of code. But what you can often do, if you can find a part of your network that maybe isn't under too high a load or isn't particularly mission critical, you know, have an actual sort of sequence of routers in which you deploy the new versions of code and which you can sort of test on. That's kind of the approach I would take.
The other way I've addressed these issues is to actually hand the problem off to Cisco. So if you are working on a certain type of network and you've got Cisco engaged to help you with the design, hand the problem over to them. And they have a team of people who specialize in selecting iOSs, and they do something called a bug scrub, which is, you can request as a service, and they will look at what services you're using in your equipment and then go off and consult the bug database inside Cisco, which you're not allowed to see because you're an external person, you don't work for Cisco, and many of the bugs inside of Cisco are not available as part of the bug database unless you're specifically given access. And they will conduct a bug scrub and tell you which version of code has no bugs related to the features that you've identified. Otherwise, as Dan said, build a lab and test it. Work it out yourself. If that sounds expensive, it is.
And that's you should do that for even your smaller stuff, especially if you got a lot of say a WAN edge router that's going out there, and you're going to build 50 of them or 100 of them or maybe thousands of them, depending on the nature of your business. You want to test every feature really thoroughly if you're intending to build a large network where you're keeping your network equipment the same as much as you can. I remember going through testing of a new router, new version of iOS, and testing a fairly lengthy list of features that we deployed on those edge routers, and we ran into a problem with SNAT, that stateful NAT, where you can mirror NATing actions between two different routers. And much to our surprise, it was broke on this. We could crash the routers very consistently by configuring SNAT in a certain way that we needed and had to move to a different version. That's something that would have absolutely killed us because we weren't deploying SNAT everywhere, but we needed it for some of our very biggest customers. And how horrible would it have been to a feature that our customers relied on for high availability, mm-hmm. and the customers that are paying the most for our services to have that service crap out on them because the iOS was broken? Oh, brother. You know, so testing can't really, yes, it costs money to have equipment to test with, but man, it can be so worth the money. You can.
It's not even the cost of the equipment. It's the cost of developing a test plan, because the only way to use test equipment is to have somebody dedicated to it, to maintaining it and having a test plan. And their job is to write test documentation and write scripts that run tests and deploy the configs automatically. And some of the places I've worked, we actually had a full-time lab and two full-time resources, and their job was to actually write scripts which put the configurations in and then ran predetermined traffic loads so that we could repeat the tests time after time after time. So when we wanted to move to a new version of code inside our carrier backbone, we would actually deploy the code onto this thing. We had a predetermined set of scripts which were more or less close to what we thought was live in our network, and these would generate traffic and throw them across the switches, and we would determine. And if it passed that, then we would go into live with the code. I didn't do that. I don't know much about it myself. It was done by much smarter people than me who knew all about Linux scripting and, you know, Perl and all these types of things and these guys. But these people knew very little relatively about iOS and how it worked, except as a general concept. So it was a, you know, different sort of a thing. There's no right answer for this.
It was one other thing we can point out about picking iOS releases, and that is that Cisco has different codes after the iOS. When you're going into the iOS library, they'll have one might be MD, you know, it's a maintenance deployment. One is ED, early deployment, and so on. MD is a good place to be if you can get there in the iOS train that you're trying to load onto a device. MD means we haven't been screwing with writing new features. We've just been fixing bugs. It's a maintenance deployment. If it wasn't broken before, we hopefully didn't break it in this release, and we've just been fixing things. So that's a nice place to be if you're just trying to get a stable iOS that's got all the features in it that you need. And I've been trying to go there. In the 12.4 mainline train, there are maintenance releases of 12.4.25. 12.4.25c, I think, is current there. And then in 15.01... C3 or something along those lines is a maintenance deployment for some of the new stuff that's running the 15.0 code.
Yeah, you need to be familiar with the iOS release train model and how the code trains are broken up to help select that. So that's a good point, Ethan, which is to say go and find out about the release trains and how Cisco forks them into different trains for different purposes and how they bring them back together again. So that would help you with your code selection. Maybe that's a topic of a whole show.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's one other point I'd make, which is that when you do deploy a new version of code, make sure that you've gone through the correct change management procedure, or if you don't have one, make sure that other people know you've done it, so that if the thing does crap out, at least other people can have a good guess as to why.
Good point. Okay, well, thanks everybody for writing into us and letting us know what you're thinking. Really appreciate your emails. Feel free to write us more at packetpushers@gmail.com. We're tossing up whether to let people record a piece of audio and send it in and play it out. If somebody wants to do that, we'll give it a go in the next couple of shows where I think what we might try and do is answer one or two questions every week as part of our regular show. So please write in, or for those of you who have the capability to record something and send it in, I'll give that a try. No promises, I'll try. Is there anything else we want to talk about, guys?
Oh, man, if we didn't get enough stuff in this show. this was plenty to talk about,
Right. Okay, well, that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so make sure you come back. Dan, thanks for being on the show this week. What's happening with you?
Still more data center deployments for me.
That's all you do, isn't it?
Repetitive, admittedly, but yeah, pretty much.
Fair enough.
Build
Ethan,
them big and build them wide.
Ethan, anything happening with you this week you want to bring up?
I am hoping work is going to be a little bit quieter. I'm still rolling out new equipment and bringing out F5s and so on. But I need to get back to blogging. I don't think I've blogged anything in of the 6 or 8 blogs I've been maintaining. I think I've contributed 0 articles to those things. Anyway, if I do blog, it's probably going to be at packetattack.wordpress.com. And of course, I have been tweeting, and you can follow me at ECBanks.
Marvelous. I'll be posting a few more blogs this week about the HP Network Day, seeing as I traveled over to Sacramento to do that. It seems right to probably talk a little bit about it. There's lots of interesting things about the HP line. I'm not convinced. Just before you think I've become an HP fanboy, I remain dubious about execution. We need to wait and see how HP actually executes and how their products work. but we didn't cover a lot of the details technically, and hopefully we'll see some more of that in the future. You can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter at etherealmind. If you want to get in contact, leave feedback, please do so at packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on the shows. We read those. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And remember, too much networking.